From New York, this is Democracy Now!
There were five or six of them. They were just walking and just shooting like this. They did not shoot upwards. They did not scream. They did not say, everyone lay down, we will kill you, and etc. They were just walking and gunning down everyone methodically in silence.
ISIS-K claims responsibility for Friday's attack on a Russian concert hall that killed at least 137 people. We'll look at how Putin is responding with New School professor Nina Khrushcheva and The New Yorker's Moscow correspondent Joshua Yaffa. Then to Gaza.
Up to 16% of children under 5 in northern Gaza are now malnourished, compared with less than 1% before the conflict began. Virtually all households are already skipping meals every day, and adults are reducing their meals so children can eat.
We'll speak with the World Peace Foundation's Alex Dvall, who says we're about to witness in Gaza the most intense famine since the Second World War. We'll also speak with him about the catastrophic hunger crisis looming in Sudan.
By all measures, the sheer scale of humanitarian needs, the numbers of people displaced and facing hunger, Sudan is one of the worst humanitarian disasters in recent memory.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Russia, the death toll has risen to 137 from an attack on a popular concert hall in Moscow on Friday. Authorities say gunmen opened fire inside a sold-out rock concert, then set the venue ablaze, the Crocus City Hall. More than 100 people were also injured, many in critical condition. Authorities in Russia have detained 11 people, including four men from Tajikistan who appeared in court today. They all appeared to have been badly beaten, possibly during interrogations. One suspect, who was in a wheelchair, seemed to lose consciousness during the court session. Reuters reports he may have had an eye missing. An affiliate of the Islamic State, ISIS-K, has claimed responsibility and posted video of the attack. Russian authorities have suggested Ukraine was involved in the attack, a claim strongly denied by Kyiv. We'll have more on the story after headlines with Professor Nina Khrushcheva and The New Yorker magazine's Joshua Yaffa. Horrifying accounts continue to come from Gaza City, where Israel's raid on Al-Shifa Hospital has entered a second week. Israeli forces have killed at least 170 people at the hospital and detained another 400. Survivors of the raid have told Al Jazeera Israeli tanks and armored bulldozers have driven over bodies and ambulances. Israeli forces are also attacking two other hospitals in Gaza. Meanwhile, the head of the UN Palestinian Aid Agency, UNRWA, says Israel's now denying access to all UNRWA food convoys to northern Gaza, even though the region is on the brink of famine. On Saturday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres traveled to the Rafah border crossing.
A long line of blocked relief trucks on one side of the gates. The long shadow of starvation on the other. That is more than tragic. It is a moral outrage.
Over the weekend, U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris warned against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu invading Rafah. She spoke to Rachel Scott of ABC News.
We have been clear in multiple conversations and in every way that any major military operation in Rafah would be a huge mistake.
A mistake, but would there be consequences if he does move forward?
Well, we're going to take it one step at a time, but we've been very clear in terms of our perspective on whether or not that should happen.
Are you ruling out that there would be consequences from the United States?
I am ruling out nothing.
This comes as Israel continues to carry out attacks across Gaza, where the death toll has topped 32,200. This is a Palestinian man named Yunus Qassab in Rafah.
Israel does not want a ceasefire. Instead, it wants to continue exterminating the Palestinian people. This is what Israel and America are planning simultaneously. They do not want a ceasefire. Israel seeks genocide against the Palestinian people, and particularly the Gaza Strip, and this is a crime.
At the United Nations Security Council, China and Russia Friday vetoed a Gaza ceasefire resolution drafted by the United States. China's ambassador to the UN, Zhang Jun, criticized the text because it did not actually demand a ceasefire.
The final text remains ambiguous and does not call for an immediate ceasefire, nor does it even provide an answer to the question of realizing a ceasefire in a short time. This is a clear deviation from the consensus of the Council members and fell far short of the expectations of the international community. An immediate ceasefire is a fundamental prerequisite for saving lives, expanding humanitarian access, and preventing greater conflicts.
The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, criticized Russia and China for vetoing the resolution.
So let's be honest. For all the fiery rhetoric, we all know that Russia and China are not doing anything diplomatically to advance a lasting peace or to meaningfully contribute to the humanitarian response effort.
President Biden signed a $1.2 trillion spending package to keep the federal government open until October. The Senate approved the appropriations bill 74-24. Independent Senator Bernie Sanders voted no because the bill stripped funding to UNRWA for the next year.
Tens of thousands of people are starving. UNRWA is trying to feed them. And the Israeli government and its allies like AIPAC spend much of their time lobbying to defund UNRWA, the major organization which is feeding starving people. Sadly, tragically, many members of Congress seem to be happy to be part of this starvation caucus.
In the House, the spending bill was approved 286-134. New York Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who voted no, accused Israel of committing genocide during a speech on the House floor.
If you want to know what an unfolding genocide looks like, open your eyes. It looks like the forced famine of 1.1 million innocents. It looks like thousands of children eating grass as their bodies consume themselves while trucks of food are slowed and halted just miles away. It looks like good and decent people who do nothing or too little, too late. It is against United States law to provide weapons to forces who block United States humanitarian assistance. And that is exactly what is happening right now.
Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant is in Washington, D.C. for meetings with Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and others. Axios is reporting Gallant is coming with a, quote, long list of U.S. weapons Israel wants to receive in an expedited manner. Protests continued around the world this weekend. In Ireland, tens of thousands marched in Dublin to demand a ceasefire and freedom for Palestinians. In Chile, members of the Palestinian community, which is believed to be the largest Palestinian community outside of the Arab world, gathered with allies to call on President Gabriel Boric to break off all diplomatic relations with Israel.
We stand with the oppressed and against the oppressors. We are here to say no more crimes against humanity, so we protest. No more relations with the criminal state of Israel, which insults our nation.
Here in New York, hundreds of activists gathered outside the Metropolitan Museum of Art to demand the prestigious museum and its board members cut ties with companies that benefit from Israel's assault on Gaza and commit to helping, quote, preserve Palestinian cultural heritage sites being destroyed by Israel, unquote. Activists displayed a massive 30 by 50 foot quilt on the steps of the Met, modeled after the AIDS Memorial quilt. The Palestine quilt pieced together works by 64 global artists on the theme of, quote, from oppression to liberation, free Palestine, unquote. In Senegal, early results from Sunday's presidential election put the opposition candidate Bassirou Diomaye Faye in the lead. At least five of the 18 other candidates already conceded to Faye, who's backed by the popular opposition figure Ousmane Sonko, who himself is barred from running. But former Prime Minister Amadou Ba, who has the backing of outgoing President Macky Sall, said he expects the vote could head to a runoff. A final provisional vote tally is expected Tuesday. Supporters of Sonko and Faye took to the streets to celebrate nonetheless.
I say it's great because it's democracy that's winning. Everyone thought it would never happen. Today, if these results are indeed confirmed, it's Senegal that absolutely wins.
Sunday's vote had been rescheduled after President Sall sought to delay the election, leading to large protests and accusations of an attempted power grab. Sonko and Faye were released from prison just days before the election, after Sall granted the men amnesty. Residents of Ukraine's second-largest city, Kharkiv, are facing rolling blackouts as Russia continues a wave of strikes against Ukraine's energy infrastructure. On Sunday, Russia hit an underground oil gas storage site. Meanwhile, Ukrainian forces are continuing to attack Russian oil refineries despite a warning not to do so from the United States. The Financial Times reports the Biden administration fears the attacks inside Russia could drive up oil prices and provoke retaliation. Ukraine also hit two more Russian ships and a communication center used by Russia's Black Sea Fleet. In Nigeria, at least 130 kidnapped school children from the northwestern state of Kaduna were rescued Sunday after more than 2 weeks in captivity. Previous reports had put the total number of students closer to 300, but officials said the total was actually 137. On Friday, the Nigerian army rescued 17 students kidnapped in the far northwestern Sokoto. At least 1,400 students have been abducted since 2014, with armed groups demanding ransoms for their safe return. In Brazil, police arrested two politicians and Rio de Janeiro's former police chief in a major breakthrough for the investigation into the 2018 assassination of Marielle Franco, an outspoken Rio councilwoman and activist. Investigators say brothers Chiquinho Brijão and Domingos Brijão, who also both once served on Rio de Janeiro City Council and remain in official positions, are suspected of masterminding the assassination, which also killed Franco's driver, Anderson Pedro Gomes. Former Rio Police Chief Rivaldo Barbosa is accused of obstructing investigations into the fatal shooting. Marielle Franco had fought against police brutality and became a voice for other LGBTQ and Black Brazilians who faced discrimination. Her longtime partner, Monica Benicio, spoke Sunday following news of the arrests.
Today is without a doubt an important day for democracy in Brazil. It is the beginning of a new struggle. We want everyone to be held responsible and everyone to be identified so that we can finally have justice for Marielle and Anderson.
New York Attorney General Letitia James could begin seizing some of former President Donald Trump's assets today if he fails to meet a deadline to post a $454 million bond after losing a civil fraud case in New York. Last week, Trump's attorney said the former president faces, quote, insurmountable difficulties in securing the bond after more than 30 companies refused to help him. Trump's attorneys have appealed the ruling, but a decision is not expected before today's deadline. This comes as Trump appears poised to make as much as $3 billion as the parent company of his social media platform, Truth Social, becomes a publicly traded firm following a merger last week. Meanwhile, Trump's expected back in court today in New York for a pretrial hearing in his hush money case. And in news from Capitol Hill, Republican Congressmember Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin has announced he will resign on April 19th. His seat will remain vacant until November. This will cut the House Republican majority to a one-vote margin. In other House news, Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene filed a motion Friday to remove House Speaker Mike Johnson just 5 months after he took the office after the ouster of Kevin McCarthy. In other political news, New Jersey First Lady Tammy Murphy has dropped out of the Democratic primary race for Robert Menendez's Senate seat, clearing the way for Congressmember Andy Kim and others in the Democratic primary. Menendez, who is facing multiple corruption charges, has announced he won't run in the Democratic primary, but hasn't ruled out running again as an independent if he's exonerated. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, ISIS-K claims responsibility for Friday's attack on a Russian concert hall that killed at least 137 people. We'll look at how Putin is responding. Stay with us. سكروها بوجه الناس وما عاد حدا يقدر يشوفها بعيون الناس حرقوها هدموها واحتلوا البيوت بعز شوية أحجار وياسمين تعربش على الحيطان. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Russia, the death toll has risen to 137 from an attack on a popular concert hall in Moscow Friday. Authorities say gunmen opened fire inside the Crocus City Hall during a sold-out rock concert, then set part of the venue on fire. More than 100 people were also injured, many in critical condition. A survivor described the attack.
They were just walking and shooting as they went along. There were five or six of them. They were just walking and just shooting like this. They did not shoot upwards. They did not scream. They did not say, "Everyone lay down, we will kill you," etc. They were just walking and gunning down everyone methodically in silence. Sound was echoing and we could not understand what was where.
Sunday was a day of mourning in Russia. Authorities have detained 11 people, including four men from Tajikistan, who appeared in court today. They all appeared to have suffered significant injuries, reportedly suffered during interrogations. One suspect was in a wheelchair and seemed to lose consciousness during the court session. Reuters reports he may have had an eye missing. The four are charged with terrorism and face life sentences. An affiliate of the Islamic State, ISIS-K, has claimed responsibility and posted video of the attack online. Russian authorities have suggested Ukraine was in the attack, a claim Kyiv called absurd. The U.S. Embassy had reportedly warned Russia earlier this month that it was, quote, monitoring reports that extremists have imminent plans to target large gatherings in Moscow, unquote, especially concert halls. And U.S. National Security Council spokesperson Adrienne Watson said the U.S. government had, quote, shared this information with Russian authorities in accordance with its longstanding duty to warn policy. Putin called the warnings, quote, provocative and outright blackmail in a speech last Tuesday. Today, a Kremlin spokesperson refused to respond to reporters who asked Friday if Friday was an intelligence failure.
Our special services work independently. Any help now is out of the question. Although, as you know, the day before President Putin had many phone communications, leaders of various countries, Belarus, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Turkey, and other countries whose leaders spoke with the president over the phone, the intentions to develop and improve cooperation against terrorism were voiced there. The topic was discussed. There are no contacts with the Westerners now.
For more, we're joined by two guests. In a minute, we'll speak with Nina Khrushcheva, a professor at the New School University here in New York. But first, we turn to Joshua Yaffa, contributing writer to The New Yorker magazine, their longtime Moscow correspondent, author of Between Two Fires, Truth, Ambition, and Compromise in Putin's Russia. His new piece released yesterday, How Will Putin Respond to the Terrorist Attack in Moscow? Josh, welcome back to Democracy Now! Well, how will and how is Putin responding to this attack, as we just listened to Dmitry Peskov, the longtime Kremlin spokesperson?
Well, you highlighted rightly that this is an awkward, to put it mildly, subject for Putin, given the warnings that the West made publicly through that U.S. embassy notice that you read. And there were also clearly private warnings that now the U.S. National Security Council is talking about, in which U.S. shared some intelligence about the prospect or likelihood of an attack. And Putin, at a meeting with high-ranking FSB officials, an address he gave to an FSB colloquium in 3 days before the attack, dismissed those warnings, as you said, as blackmail, as a provocation, as a kind of ruse by the West. So all of this is now, again, to put it mildly and very tragically, quite awkward for Putin, given the scale of the destruction and the terror attack last week. Putin's first instinctual reaction, I think, both with based on political calculation, but also, I think, a kind of genuine, his genuine paranoid read of how things work, was to try and cast a shadow on Ukraine, suggesting that somehow these ISIS-K terrorists had links to Ukraine, that Ukraine and perhaps the West were behind this attack. That fits very much into Putin's paranoid worldview. Of course, it's a very convenient argument and narrative for not just Putin himself, but the Kremlin information machine to the Russian public. We've seen propaganda outlets go into overdrive, state media. Margarita Simonyan, the head of RT, really pushed this narrative that somehow Ukraine must be involved, that even if the perpetrators, the ones who actually carried out the attack, were citizens of Tajikistan, perhaps doing so out of allegiance or in coordination with ISIS-K, that the real villain lies in Ukraine. And I think Putin will continue to try and push this narrative to the extent possible. We saw, as you mentioned, clear signs of torture from the suspects who were brought to Moscow court. Could torture be used to extract a kind of confession, in air quotes, from them that indeed Ukraine or the West stood behind the attack? I think that's possible. We don't know. It's also possible that given how awkward and uncomfortable this is of a subject and how it doesn't actually fit with the larger Kremlin narratives about the war in Ukraine, the necessity of that war, the standoff with the West, the United States as the main enemy, that Putin, the Kremlin, the propaganda machine of the Russian state may try and change the conversation, move on, quickly change topics and actually not devote a lot of attention to this attack and see if they can't get the Russian people to grimly absorb it, as the Russian public has had to grimly absorb so many tragedies in recent years.
I want to go to your reference to what Russian President Vladimir Putin said, suggesting Ukraine was involved in the deadly attacks on Crocus City Hall, vowing to punish all those responsible.
All four of the actual performers of the act of terror, all those who shot and killed people, were found and detained. They tried to hide, and they were moving in the direction of Ukraine. There, according to the preliminary data, they had a crossing of the border prepared from the Ukrainian side. All executors, planners, and those who ordered this crime will be rightfully and inevitably punished, whoever they are and whoever directed them. Let me repeat, we will identify and punish everyone who stood behind the terrorists, who prepared this attack against Russia, against our people.
So that's Vladimir Putin. He said that these people, the Tajiks, were headed to the Ukraine border. Talk about who ISIS-K is that claimed responsibility for this attack.
ISIS-K is a group, an affiliate of the larger ISIS, or the ISIS that we came to know in Syria and Iraq. It's based in Central Asia, Afghanistan, where it's most active, and it's engaging in a kind of civil war within the jihadi community with the Taliban, has made Russia a target, at least rhetorically, for some time, citing Russia's own campaign or the Soviet Union's campaign in Afghanistan against the Mujahideen in the 80s, all the way up to Russia's war against ISIS, its air campaign in Syria, very brutal, destructive, indiscriminate air campaign, a ground campaign involving Wagner mercenaries against ISIS in Palmyra and other sites around Syria, Russia's own repression and ongoing counterinsurgency against Muslim communities, oftentimes Muslim extremist or Muslim militant communities in the Russian North Caucasus. So there's no share of grievance on the side of ISIS-K, again, which doesn't really need to work very hard to try and find or justify targets. It's also in recent months tried to plan attacks in Europe, Germany, elsewhere. Those apparently have been foiled. So the fact that Russia is in ISIS-K's crosshairs is neither nothing new nor particularly all that surprising, given what we know about the group and Russia's own involvement in various interventions in the Muslim world over the years.
I wanted to bring into the conversation with Joshua Yaffa Nina Khrushcheva, professor of international affairs at the New School, her book titled The Lost Khrushchev, Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind, also co-author of In Putin's Footsteps, Searching for the Soul of an Empire Across Russia's 11 Time Zones. And wanted to get your response as well to this attack. You've talked about it immediately going back to 2004, the Beslan School siege, when Christian rebels, Chechen rebels, rather, occupied a school in the town of Beslan. And whether you think, as Josh was just saying, Putin, whose brand is so-called security, can just hope that this goes away very quickly in the minds of the Russian people.
Well, thank you, Amy. Putin can hope that it goes away. It doesn't go away. There have been at least three instances already since Friday where various venues, including hospitals, have been bomb warnings, and they've been evacuated. So that seems to be going on, even if there is no bombing and perhaps there are false warnings. It is really to destabilize this Putin's claim that Russia is stable. And of course, when we talk about Putin's or Russia's state dealings with the Islamic fundamentalists, it goes back even to 2002 when a theater during the performance of Nordost was attacked. And then, of course, Beslan School is 2006. Then there's been a study done that from 1995 to 2006, I mean, it's not a clear number, but approximate number, about 20,000 people have been killed in those attacks by Islamic fundamentalists. Then, of course, there's other instances, the 2011, the 2007, the 2017, all in subways or other places in Russia. And also, that is the first time when Russia dealt with ISIS, with ISIS-K, with this group that attacked on Friday was in 2022, where the Russian embassy in Kabul was bombed and two people were killed then. So really, there's been more than one or two. There have been over 10 or even 20 instances of Putin's or Russia's dealing with it. And in his performance, in his sort of response to the attack, when he spoke for about 6 minutes after the attack on Saturday, yesterday, he spoke about the Nazis, because that's the important message that he needs to deliver, since his whole point in Ukraine is denazification of Ukraine. So he needed to make this kind of connection, while in truth, of course, he should have been talking about the kind of Muslim treatment in Russia and the Islamic fundamentalist threat that is not just in Russia, but all over. And that's unfortunate, because Russia seems to be denying global cooperation, and that will create more problems, not just for the world, but for Russia, inside Russia, for sure.
Now, just to say, ISIS-K has targeted the United States, but the United States has left Afghanistan. They've targeted Pakistan, repeatedly targeted China, as well as Russia. The significance of these are different lines than we traditionally see. You know, you're either attacking Russia or the United States. We see it very much as an east-west line. ISIS-K doesn't.
Exactly, it doesn't. And that's why when Peskov says we have no cooperation with the West, that's unfortunate, because exactly that, and in fact, Putin himself, 20 years ago, he was the one who was encouraging the George Bush administration, George Bush Jr. administration, to work together. He was the one, in fact, even in 2015, 2014, was encouraging Barack Obama to work together on this kind of issues. Clearly, that time has long gone, and now Putin is going to be a lone actor in this, which unfortunately it really doesn't bode well for Russia, because we probably will see more attacks like that. And if Russia is not going to listen to Western warnings or any warnings, then in fact, how it is going to fight a rising threat? I mean, we saw already that France has raised its security level to the highest level. So if it is a threat, once again, a global one, and Russia will be left alone to do that, that would become a problem.
Joshua Yaffa, the piece that you wrote before this piece that you wrote on how will Putin respond to the attack came around the time of the second anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. It's headlined how Putin's invasion of Ukraine improved his standing in Putin's invasion of Ukraine improved his standing in Russia. And you write, Putin's authoritarian drift has accelerated into something resembling a full-blown military dictatorship. How will this attack impact where he's headed? I mean, we see overnight massive attacks on Ukraine trying to, do you think it's trying to redirect attention back to Ukraine? And what do you say to those who are saying they were headed to the Ukraine border, that whether or not some of these attackers were Tajik, that there's some hand in it by Ukraine?
I'd say a few things. One, indeed, this is a trend that began before the war, but accelerated greatly since Russia's invasion, which is Russia's authoritarian drift, empowering of the security services, really the FSB, the main security service, becoming kind of the political police of Russia. These are trends that began a long time ago, have accelerated since the invasion. But what we see is that for all of Putin's authoritarian kind of gathering of authoritarian control and handing over much authority to the FSB, that these institutions are there to protect the regime, not the Russian people. And I think that that's the great lesson of late stage Putinism, what we're witnessing now, but really true of so many autocracies, that as they hand more and more control to things like security services, secret police, carry out mass repressions against their own citizens. A analysis by a group named Proyekt, an independent Russian media outlet, counted more political prisoners under Putin than were under the leadership of Khrushchev or Brezhnev in the Soviet period. So we're talking about a massive number of Russian citizens facing these repressions. And what is it all for? Not to actually keep Russia or its population safe, but to keep the regime safe. And I think that's important to understand, both in trying to determine how did this attack happen in the first place, and also what might Putin's response be going forward. First and foremost, he cares about preserving his own power and the continued stability of his ruling system. How he might respond in terms of lashing out at Ukraine, trying to redirect attention to Ukraine. You mentioned a massive Russian drone and missile attack against Ukrainian targets today against the center of Kiev. A university, among other targets, was struck. The city of Kharkiv is undergoing rolling blackouts. You also mentioned, so yes, of course, this will be tempting for the Kremlin to try and deflect from the real, by all accounts, source of this terror attack, Muslim fundamentalism. ISIS tried to redirect to a more convenient, sellable target, Ukraine, that fits more in line with Russian overall Russian propaganda messaging. But it's not really clear how much they're is slack in the rope, so to speak, for Russia to escalate more in Ukraine. What can it do more than it's already doing? These attacks against Ukrainian cities, against Ukrainian infrastructure, they have been going on, well, really for 2 years since the invasion began. But in last weeks, we've seen Russia ramp up the scale of its these kind of swarm attacks of ballistic missiles, drones against especially energy targets, trying to force blackouts, heating shutoffs and crises across Ukraine. So all of that was happening before these attacks. Can Russia do more of it? I guess, but it's hard to think of Russia escalating in a qualitative way beyond what it's been doing for the past 2 years. As to whether or not there was actually any Ukrainian links to this account, there's been absolutely zero credible evidence of this that has emerged. The suspects were detained on a highway near the Russian city of Bryansk. It's about 140 kilometers from Ukraine. Were they actually headed to Ukraine? Who knows? The idea that they would cross one of the most monitored and heavily militarized borders in the world. Just imagine what the border between two countries at war looks like. The amount of military personnel, intelligence personnel that are watching that border, the idea that people who just committed a terror attack and could kind of easily sneak across the border seems a little far-fetched to me. But again, we don't even know exactly, were they planning to cross the border? Were they planning to cross the border to Belarus? To say that they were apprehended at the Ukrainian border is a bit of a stretch, given we're talking about a distance of 140 kilometers. And beyond that fact, which really in and of itself may not amount to much, there's really no other evidence whatsoever that would suggest Ukraine has anything to do with this attack beyond the Kremlin's understandable urge to try and force that narrative first and foremost on the Russian public to explain why the Kremlin didn't see this coming and wasn't able to prevent it.
Professor Khrushcheva, to talk about those energy attacks, this from the Financial Times, the U.S. has urged Ukraine to halt attacks on Russia's energy infrastructure, warning the drone strikes risk driving up global oil prices and provoking retaliation. Your response?
Well, and it is, because the Joshua just talked about the recent Russian attacks that were before the Friday terrorist event. In fact, during the elections, during that process of Putin's new term of the president, Ukraine escalated its attacks on the cities around the Russian border and on the oil and gas infrastructure. So Russia retaliates back. So in a sense, it becomes, you know, escalation on one side, escalation on the other side. This is not to equate, because obviously Russia is an invader, but it is, you know, the escalation now in the last month has been going on both sides. I don't think Ukraine cares. I mean, Ukrainians did say they understand what the United States is asking for, but they really can't care about this because they are at war. They fight the way they can, especially now when the Western aid, especially the aid from the United States, has been stalling in Congress. They have to do something. So they're doing what they can. And I don't think it's quite fair on the part of other parties involved to say, well, don't do it, because they're at war and they have to fight by any means, by the means possible.
Joshua, you write in your piece, ISIS is on the Kremlin's list of terrorist and extremist organizations, but so was Alexei Navalny's political network. And on the day of the attack, Friday, Russia added the, quote, worldwide LGBT movement to the same list. What purpose does this list serve?
That's a very fair question that I would be that would be difficult for me to answer convincingly or rationally. But the existence of this list, or rather its composition, the fact that you have ISIS on the same list of banned terrorist and extremist organizations next to Alexei Navalny's political and anti-corruption foundation, or something that I'm not even sure any fair-minded person could understand how to define, the so-called worldwide LGBT movement, whatever that is, shows the Kremlin's priorities in how it sees or what it sees as true dangers. And this gets back to what I said a moment ago, that the existence of this security apparatus and the reason for this granting so much power to organizations like the FSB, the scale of political repression we've seen in Russia, it's not about protecting the Russian people. This is a point I made a minute ago. It's about first and foremost protecting the political power and the political regime of Vladimir Putin. And who is a threat for Vladimir Putin? Well, for example, the political organization with field offices at one point around the country of Alexei Navalny. LGBT movement, again, whatever that really means, to talk about the worldwide LGBT movement, but by stigmatizing and scapegoating LGBT movement and individuals, Putin is able to present his war in Ukraine as a kind of civilizational values war against the decadent West with its same-sex marriages and trans rights and so on. So except there are very real human costs behind the inclusion and stigmatization and scapegoating of groups, for example, like LGBT community. Just this week, the first prosecutions or the first arrests we've seen of two people in connection with violation of this law. In other words, these are two people who owned a gay bar in Russia. They have been arrested for this fact and could face prison sentences of up to 9 years for aiding this so-called extremist terrorist organization. So one does have to wonder about the priorities of a political system and a government that equates ISIS terrorists with owners of a gay bar. Who are they devoting resources to track, to monitor, to go after? How are those resources being allocated? And I think some obvious questions immediately arise about, again, the true motives and interests of such a regime based on where they parcel out resources, who they see as enemies, and who are they policing, ISIS terrorists or the owners of gay bars?
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. We'll continue, of course, to follow what has taken place in Moscow. Joshua Yaffa, contributing writer to The New Yorker magazine, longtime Moscow correspondent, speaking to us now from Berlin, Germany. His new piece will link to how will Putin respond to the terrorist attack in Moscow. And Nina Khrushcheva, professor at the New School, author of The Lost Khrushchev, and co-author of In Putin's Footsteps. This is Democracy Now!. This breaking news: the Boeing CEO Dave Calhoun has announced he plans to resign by the end of the year. In addition, Boeing's chairman and the head of Boeing's commercial airplane unit are also leaving. The Justice Department recently opened a criminal probe into the company. There is a meme going around that says, when one door closes, another one opens. Boeing. Next up, we'll speak with the World Peace Foundation's Alex DeWall, who says we're about to witness in Gaza the most intense famine since the Second World War. We'll also talk to him about catastrophic hunger in Sudan. Back in 20 seconds. سيبي همومك في وادي بعيد بين الورود بدعب النسيم ميلي علي دايرة ضوج العسل شوية يلا أرقص وفرفش لي انت الحلم وطيف البزور المنام انت السعادة اللي بتنور علي Barasha, Butterfly Balasala. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to Gaza, where aid groups say famine is imminent after 5 months of U.S.-backed attacks by Israel. The head of the U.N. Palestinian Aid Agency, UNRWA, says Israel is now denying access to all UNRWA food convoys to northern Gaza, even though the region is on the brink of famine. UNRWA chief Philippe Lazzarini wrote on X, quote, "This man-made starvation under our watch is a stain on our collective humanity." On Saturday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres traveled to the Rafah border crossing.
A long line of blocked relief trucks on one side of the gates, the long shadow of starvation on the other. That is more than tragic. It is a moral outrage. It's time to truly flood Gaza with life-saving aid. The choice is clear, either surge or starvation. Let's choose the side of help, the side of hope, and the right side of history.
For more, we're joined by Alex Duvall, the executive director of the World Peace Foundation at Tufts University, and author of Mass Starvation, The History and Future of Famine. His new piece for The Guardian, we're about to witness in Gaza the most intense famine since the Second World War. Alex, welcome back to Democracy Now! Describe what's happening at a time when Israel's now preventing the largest aid umbrella in Gaza, UNRWA, from delivering aid to northern Gaza, where famine is the most intense.
Let's make no mistake. We talk about imminent famine or being at the brink of famine. When a population is in this extreme cataclysmic food emergency, already children are dying in significant numbers of hunger and needless disease, the two interacting in a vicious spiral that is killing them, likely in thousands already. It's very arbitrary to say we're at the brink of famine. It is a particular measure of the utter extremity of threat to human survival. So, and we have never actually, since the metrics for measuring acute food crisis were developed some 20 years ago, we have never seen a situation either in which an entire population, the entire population of Gaza, is in food crisis, food emergency, or famine, or such simple large numbers of people descending into starvation. It simply hasn't happened before in our lifetimes.
How can it be prevented?
Well, it's been very clear. Back in December, the Famine Review Committee of the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification System, and that is the sort of the ultimate arbiter, the high court, if you like, of humanitarian assessments, made it absolutely clear. And I can quote, the cessation of hostilities in conjunction with the sustained restoration of humanitarian access to the Gaza Strip remain the essential prerequisites for preventing famine. It said that in December. It reiterated it again last week. There is no way that this disaster can be prevented without a ceasefire and without a full spectrum of humanitarian relief and restoring essential services.
Can you explain what the IPC is and also talk about the effects of famine for the rest of the lives of those who survive, of children?
So the IPC, which is short for the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification System, is the system that the international humanitarian agencies adopted some 20 years ago to try and come to a standardized metric. And it uses fivefold classification of food insecurity, and it comes out in very clearly color-coded maps, which are very easy to understand. So green is phase one, which is normal. Yellow is phase two, which is stressed. Orangey-brown is phase three, that is crisis. Red is four, that is emergency. And in the very first prototype, actually, of the IPC, this was called famine, but they reclassified it as emergency. And dark blood red is catastrophe, or famine. And this measures the intensity. There's also the question of the magnitude, the sheer numbers involved, which in the case of Gaza means essentially the entire population of over 2 million. Now, starvation is not just something that that is experienced and from which people can recover. We have long-standing evidence, and the best evidence actually is from Holland, where the Dutch population suffered what they called the hunger winter back in 1944 at the end of World War II. And the Dutch have been able to track the lifelong effects of starvation of young children and children who are not yet born in utero. And they find that those children, when they grow up, are shorter, they are stunted, and they have lower cognitive capacities than their elder or younger siblings. And this actually even goes on to the next generation. So when little girls who are exposed to this grow and become mothers, their own children also suffer those effects, albeit on at a lesser scale. So this will be a calamity that will be felt for generations.
What are you calling for, Alex Duvall? I mean, in a moment, we're going to talk about what's happening in Sudan. It's horrifying to go from one famine to another. But the idea that we're talking about completely man-made situation here.
Indeed, it is not only man-made, and therefore it is men who will stop it. And sadly, of course, even if there is a ceasefire and humanitarian assistance, it will be too late to save the lives of hundreds, probably thousands of children who are at the brink now and are living in these terrible, overcrowded situations without basic water, sanitation and services. It is a crisis like this cannot be stopped overnight. It is a crisis that is not just a humanitarian crisis. It is fundamentally a political crisis, a crisis of an abrogation of essentially agreed international humanitarian law, and indeed international criminal law. There is overwhelming evidence that this is the war crime of starvation being perpetrated at scale.
Alex Duvall, we're going to turn now from what's happening in Gaza. We'll link to your piece. We're about to witness in Gaza the most intense famine since the Second World War. We now turn to Sudan, where around half the population has become reliant on food aid. As the United Nations warns, the war-torn country is on track to become the world's worst hunger crisis.
Malnutrition is soaring to alarming levels and is already claiming children's lives. A recent MSF report revealed that one child is dying every 2 hours in Zamzam camp in El Fasher, North Darfur. Our humanitarian partners estimate that in the coming weeks and months, somewhere in the region of around 222,000 children could die from malnutrition. And with the estimated, WHO estimates that more than 70% of health facilities are not functional.
The conflict between the Sudanese military and the rival Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, erupted nearly a year ago on April 15th, 2023. It's displaced over 8 million people, around 90% of the population facing emergency levels of food insecurity in Sudan are in Khartoum, Darfur, and Kordofan, areas which have seen some of the most intense fighting. But the UN's appeal for $2.7 billion for Sudan is less than 5% funded. Aid's also drying up in Chad, where some 1.2 million Sudanese have taken refuge. The war has also led to many reports of armed forces using rape and sexual violence as a weapon, and some 19 million children have been deprived of school. Alex Duvall, famine is your area of expertise. You're executive director of the World Food World Peace Foundation at Tufts University and author of the book Mass Starvation, The History and Future of Famine. What concerns you most about what's happening in Sudan right now?
So Sudan is a different kind of food crisis and famine compared to Gaza. This is one of enormous magnitude. The sheer numbers that are afflicted are hard to grapple with. Sudan is a country of almost 50 million people. Half of them are in emergency situation now. You said earlier, reliant on food aid. Frankly, unfortunately, the food aid is not there. Even as we speak, the World Food Programme, which is the largest food aid producer, is cutting its budget. It's cutting its staff by 30% because it's not getting the money it needs. It's not a perfect system by any means, but it's the only system that we've got. And what particularly alarms me about Sudan are really three things. Number one is that unlike previous food crises in Sudan, the actual core of the economy is being destroyed. The breadbasket of Sudan is not functioning, is not growing food. Secondly, it's a crisis not just in Sudan. Most of the neighbors are affected. You mentioned Chad, also South Sudan, formerly part of Sudan, is also facing a major food emergency. And Ethiopia next door at the same time. And we've never seen so many neighboring countries in this region descending into food emergency at the same time. And this is all happening while the international emergency system is being squeezed. It's facing major cuts. We are simply not responding as required. It's quite calamitous.
I wanted to go to a clip from UNICEF, which warns hundreds of thousands of Sudanese children are suffering from severe malnutrition. This is Jill Lawler, Chief of Field Operations and Emergency for UNICEF in Sudan.
The numbers of acutely malnourished children are rising, and the lean season hasn't even begun. Nearly 3.7 million children are projected to be acutely malnourished this year in Sudan, including 730,000 who need life-saving treatment. The needs for children in Khartoum alone are massive, but this is also true in Darfur, where I was last month on a cross-border mission through Chad. The scale and magnitude of needs for children across the country are simply staggering. Sudan is now the world's largest displacement crisis, and some of the most vulnerable children are in the hardest to reach places.
So how is this remedied, Alex Duvall? Again, nearly 230,000 children, pregnant mothers and new mothers could die, it's being predicted, in the next few months due to hunger.
Indeed, this is the largest sort of mass mortality crisis that we are facing in the world, and the largest that we have probably faced for many decades, certainly the largest since I started working on this topic 40 years ago at the time of the Ethiopian and Sudanese famines that many will remember from the Live Aid concerts. How is it to be stopped? I mean, the two most immediate things are a ceasefire and the end to the destruction of what is necessary to sustain life and produce food in Sudan. And there doesn't seem to be much sign of that. There's not really much pressure on the warring parties to come to any sort of even basic agreement. They seem to want to continue to fight it out. And various countries are pouring in arms into the country to escalate the conflict. But the other is also to fund this humanitarian operation that is, as you mentioned, totally underfunded at the moment. There are almost no resources available to provide the necessities for people.
And in fact, the World Food Program, you know, we were talking about Gaza. We were talking about the massive cuts to UNRWA. The World Food Program of the United Nations has also massive cuts.
Indeed, it's shocking. I was trying to talk just a few days ago to some old colleagues who work on these issues, and I find that they've been reassigned or they've lost their jobs. We only have one global emergency response system at the moment, and that is centered upon the World Food Programme. And so we need to make it work, because if it doesn't work, we're going to find ourselves facing the kinds of crises of mass mortality that we have simply not seen for half a century or longer.
Well, Alex Saval, we thank you so much for being with us, Executive Director of the World Peace Foundation at Tufts University, author of the book Mass Starvation, The History and Future of Famine. We'll link to your pieces on Sudan and Gaza and more. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Shruhav Dokadus, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Teresena, Tammy Warrenoff, Charina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Masood, and Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.